listening to our music by our featured artist today, the late trumpeter Lee Morgan. It's from his 1966 recording on Blue Note, the album called Delightful Lee. Of course, a tune written by Lee called Night Flight. Features Joe Henderson on the tenor sax, McCoy Tyner piano, Bob Cranshaw bass, Billy Higgins on the drums. And of course, as I mentioned before, we're going to be doing a live interview with author Jeff McMillan on one of my favorite musicians, of course, trumpeter Lee Morgan, one of the major trumpeters of the 1960s. Lee Morgan's career both started early and ended prematurely. He was born in Philadelphia, and he was playing professionally by the age of 15. And by the time that he was 18, he was a member of Dizzy Gillespie's big band. He joined Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers when he was just 20 years old. A serious drug problem, though, would force Morgan to take a lower profile. But he came back in 1963 with the hit recording The Sidewinder, which we played at the beginning of the show. And during the second half of the 1960s, Lee Morgan evolved from a hard bop trumpeter to one who, while still swinging, was open to the influences of the avant-garde, modal music, and even some pop elements. Morgan was only 33 when he was shot and killed in 1972 by his longtime girlfriend, leaving fans to wonder what he would have accomplished in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Joining us today to discuss the late great trumpeter is Jeff McMillan, author of a new book called Delightful Lee, The Life and Music of Lee Morgan, which is published by the University of Michigan Press. And Mr. McMillan received his master's degree from the Jazz History and Research Program at Rutgers University in Newark in 2000 and currently works as an archivist for the Metropolitan Opera. And Mr. McMillan, welcome to Return to the Source and WJAB.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Now, Jeff, if we look at Lee, one of the things in your book, let's begin with sort of the role that Philadelphia would play and the role of Morgan's family. In fact, I think a case can be made that Philadelphia is one of the most important cities in jazz history, given the number of outstanding musicians who came from there. We sort of always like to think of New York as sort of the primary city, and I guess all musicians have to go to New York, but as Bobby Hutcherson once told me, they all came from somewhere else. So what was Lee's early life like in Philadelphia, and what role did his family play in his early development?
Well, you're absolutely right that the role of Philadelphia can't be underestimated for Lee Morgan's development, because in the 1950s, Philadelphia was just a hotbed of activity, and there were a lot of young players interacting with a lot of the professional players who are well established and coming into town playing at places like the Showboat and Pep's, the Blue Note. And people of Lee's generation, the younger kids, were able to interact with people like Miles Davis and Errol Garner, people coming in and playing and sharing little tips with the up-and-coming players.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and Jeff, if we look at in terms of Philadelphia, and I always mention this too, because I also had a chance to talk with Sonny Fortune here on the show. Of course, he was also from Philadelphia, and he happened to mention Kenny Rogers, who you mentioned in your book, and he mentioned Kenny Rogers to me as sort of a horn player who, you know, a lot of people had heard of. He'd never left Philadelphia.
Yeah.
But I'm sure in every city there are musicians like that. But tell me a little bit about Lee's career, not his career, but his experience at Mossbaum High School. I understand that was a pretty good high school in Philadelphia at the time.
Oh, yeah. At the time, it was one of the top music programs for any high school. There was Mossbaum, and there was Cass Tech, and Detroit. But these schools were just, they were very well known, and they attracted students who would, you know, audition for these programs in order to be involved with the training that was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And these are high schools, you know. Mm-hmm. Kind of what you would think of for like a college level interest in music.
Mm-hmm.
These kids were very young and very ambitious, and Lee was one of them, and he was very driven as a young student, as was Kenny Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talked to Jimmy Morgan about, you know, how Lee was when he was coming up, that Jimmy is Lee's older brother, and he talked about how Kenny and Lee would go around calling themselves the Bird and Diz of Philly.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kenny was a little older than Lee, and he was the one who really kind of expressed you know, what great training there was to be had at MassBomb, and kind of convinced him to be involved with it.
Well, you know, Jeff, and I think that also points to because as you mentioned in the book, I guess a lot of the students who went to MassBomb, of course, were sort of also preparing themselves for perhaps musical careers, and in particular with symphony orchestras. But at that time, of course, for students like Lee, there were not a lot of opportunities for blacks in many of the symphonies at that time. And I remember talking with bassist Richard Davis, who also had started out wanting to be, you know, a classical player, but there were very few opportunities for him in terms of symphony orchestras. Did the same thing happen to Lee in some respect?
Absolutely. Well, I think Lee, you know, one of his high school classmates put it very well when he said Lee knew his destiny from the very beginning. You know, he connected with the music of Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and the records that were coming out in the early 1950s, and that's what he wanted to do. But he was such a dedicated student of the trumpet, and he was studying with a guy who was certainly more of a classical music orientation, and Lee just wanted to learn how to do it all.
Mm-hmm.
And though he connected more with the jazz idiom, you know, he could have excelled doing anything when it came to the trumpet.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk a little bit, and once again, I'm talking with Jeff McMillan. He's the author of a new book called Delightful Lee, The Life and Music of Lee Morgan. And as I understand it, Jeff, 1956, that was a big year for Lee. Of course, prior to that, he had met Clifford Brown, who would have a big influence. Talk a little bit about the relationship between Clifford Brown and that very young Lee Morgan.
Yeah, well, Clifford was living in West Philly at the time, and Lee had met him at a place called the Heritage House, which was a place where, you know, established musicians would come and give a performance during the day while, you know, they'd be playing at a club at night. And that was an opportunity for the kids who were too young to go to the clubs could come and interact with the star musicians. And Lee formed a relationship with Clifford, and, you know, Clifford really took him under his wing, and the two became very close. And, then, you know, Lee would go by Clifford's house in West Philly all the time, and, you know, Clifford's widow, LaRue, one time told me about how Lee would be sitting on the stairs, you know, waiting for the two of them to come home, and so Lee could get, you know, get together with Clifford and just start going over things and start chatting, and, you know, they were very close.
Yeah, and of course, so in terms of him being, and really, you know, Clifford probably was not that much older than Lee at that particular time.
No, I think Clifford was born in 1930, so make him 8 years older.
Yeah, okay. Now, let's talk a little bit, and as we said, 1956 was a big year because, of course, that was the year that Clifford would die in an auto accident. And that would have a big impact on Lee. But it also was the year in which Lee began to fill in with the Messengers. And I think this is also a time where in your book you talk about Benny Golson and some of the early influence of Benny Golson on Lee Morgan. And, of course, Benny Golson being another one of those outstanding musicians from Philadelphia. And I don't think really Benny Golson gets enough credit in terms of what he has done in terms of both a composer and a player and even his influence on the Messengers. So talk a little bit about the influence that Benny Golson would have on Lee Morgan.
Well, Benny Golson knew Lee from in Philadelphia before they were both in the Gillespie band, but they were more, you know, performing in different bands around Philly. But it was in the Gillespie band that Golson really had a tremendous impact on Lee's developing career, because Golson had been around for a little longer. He's part of the older generation, and when Lee came into the band as, you know, the young phenom, and was, you know, attracting a lot of attention from the record companies, it was Benny Golson who really helped him get organized for record dates and wrote material for him and, you know, helped compose these performances on the records to make, you know, Lee have as good an impact as possible as, you know, a player who was certainly capable of making an emphatic entrance.
Yeah.
You know, Benny was instrumental in putting those kind of charts together to really exploit Lee's talents.
And it was Lee,
Lee loved it. You know, Lee really appreciated Golson's impact on his developing career and utilized his services for, you know, those 2 years.
Yeah. In fact, it would be Lee who would first record I Remember Clifford, right?
Well, no.
No?
I think it was Art Farmer.
Okay, okay.
Or no, I'm sorry, Donald Byrd.
Donald Byrd.
Who was the first to record it.
Okay.
Lee was the first to record Whisper Not.
Whisper Not.
Which is, you know, probably Benny Golson's best known.
Yeah, among his many compositions.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of Lee, once he began to sort of fill in with the Messengers, I think you also mentioned this was a time when he began to then really began to dabble in drugs and I guess would develop what would become a serious drug habit.
Right.
In terms of Lee, just how strong was his drug habit? And I'm sure you think that it had a major impact on his playing at this time.
Oh, I think so. You know, Lee, he began using drugs pretty seriously when he was with Art Blakey. And, you know, his partner towards the end of his life, Helen Morgan, told the story about how, you know, Art was the one who turned him on to heroin.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he asked Art, you know, how long does the high last? And Art said, forever. And, you know, it certainly became an important part of his life.
Yeah.
And it, you know, derailed him a number of times. But the thing that's really fascinating to me about Lee Morgan is as serious as his drug addiction was and as debilitating as it was at times, he kept bouncing back.
Yeah.
With creativity and, you know, as a trumpet player, being able to play on these sessions, you know, when he didn't even have an instrument. You know, his chops, he could get his chops into good shape and sound really strong.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's such a physical instrument, yet, you know, he had a real knack for being able to get it done, even when his chops were, you know, through lack of use or not having an instrument because of his addiction.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jeff, because in fact, I've talked with a couple of you know, close friends, musician friends of Lee here on the show, Cedar Walton.
Oh.
I've also talked with Billy Harper, and of course, they both sort of talked about how, you know, despite the fact that Lee was a drug addict, he was a very nice guy, although, once again, because he was a drug addict, he could often do things that drug addicts would do, but he was a very nice guy.
Right. Right. And, yeah, Mr. Harper is a great one because he saw Lee at the end of his life,
yeah,
when he was really cleaning up his addiction to heroin and, you know, trying to overcome a lot of his vices.
Yeah, well,
and he saw, you know, Lee kind of rebuild himself, and, you know, he always, yeah, he definitely said Lee was always a prankster, you know, kind of a joker, a very, you know, almost like a childlike personality.
Yeah, yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about, and during this time when Lee would begin playing with the Jazz Messengers, another big influence on him would be tenor saxophonist Wayne Shorter. Talk a little bit about the influence of Wayne Shorter, who also happens to be one of my favorite musicians.
Yeah, well, Wayne Shorter was, I think, one of the first to really encourage Lee to work on his compositions. Because before that, Lee was, you know, he was kind of experimenting with writing, and, you know, he written a tune for a Blue Note date that eventually became Clifford Jordan's date. But, you know, that's kind of an isolated thing. It wasn't until much later, when Wayne Shorter was in the Messengers with him, that Lee started really working on tunes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he owned a piano, and he got very serious about it. He would, you know, work on tunes all night. And I think Wayne was, you know, kind of Lee's generation. He was also a very creative and just really driven creative mind.
Mm-hmm.
And Lee really benefited from being so close to him during that time because, you know, he was inspired by it.
Yeah.
And he experimented with a lot of different forms and compositional context, and I think some of his tunes are just very successful, very memorable.
Well, he had a
very exceptional gift with melody. I think some of the tunes, like Sidewinders, definitely one of them, Ciora, Speedball, I mean, these are tunes that when you hear them, you can remember them.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a gift.
Well, you mentioned sort of the Calypso thing, because I was going to ask you about what I kind of see as a Latin tinge. It's just something that sounded Latin about a lot of Lee's compositions, and that's another thing that sort of gave him that his own kind of style. And I've also heard this term used describing him swashbuckling, and his tunes do sort of have that swashbuckling kind of sound to them. Yeah. But I think about tunes like Caramba and as you said, Ciora and Hey Chico and some other tunes that he wrote. Sure. Where did this Latin thing come from? Because, you know, I used to think Lee might have been part Latin. And he looks like he could have been at some point, you know.
Well, I think he has Native American ancestry.
Okay.
Also, but the Latin thing, I think he really began to experiment with the calypso and kind of Caribbean flavor music in the mid or early 1960s.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of on the heels of, you know, the bossa nova craze in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the Black Orpheus and, you know, the music of Herbie Mann and Stan Getz.
Yeah, yeah.
That stuff was incredibly popular. And I think Lee may have wanted to get a piece of that pie, you know, because it was an idiom that was very successful.
Yeah, yeah.
And he, in an interview, he once said that he loved the way that kind of bossa nova beat really opened up opportunities for him melodically.
Uh-huh.
In his solos.
Although
he felt like he wasn't just running changes, he could just kind of play little songs on a song.
Although I would never heard him or would say that he was trying to, you know, find some kind of commercial kind of bossa nova sound, but it just had that Latin thing to it. Whenever I hear Lee's compositions, it always puts me in the mind of that.